From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we learn what the people of Michigan think it'll take to revive our state's economy and rebuild the Michigan dream.
We want communities we can be proud to live in that are attractive places to live and work. And they're saying it's embarrassing that the roads are crumbling. Why would anyone want to have a business here?
Plus, an insider's view of the financial crunch for our universities and colleges.
There is a certain belief that maybe universities are not efficient enough, they're not productive enough.
And to look at online learning for Michigan students.
Online learning is not going to be the panacea for all learners, but for many, many kids, it's going to be a new path that's going to allow them to be successful.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, Michiganders, you have spoken. A new report is out today about how you think we can move the economy forward. We'll find out more on today's show. And we speak to a former university president who says universities themselves might be contributing to some of the economic crunch they're facing. But first, the question of just how much support the state of Michigan should be giving to the film industry and to filmmakers. Governor Snyder's recent budget proposal contained $25 million in tax credits for filmmakers. Now, that's a 50% cut from the present film credit cap of $50 million. And some lawmakers, including Republican Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville, are saying that is one bad idea. He fears it'll drive the film industry out of Michigan.
To that particular industry and to the mostly blue-collar workers that benefit from that in Michigan, that would be devastating to them. The decision-making has been unstable. It makes some of these big investments scarier investments, riskier investments. And so, you know, that's why we have people moving to North Carolina to take filmmaking jobs.
Richardville and others in the state legislature, both Republican and Democrat, want to fight to keep the credits at $50 million. Now, the person who's charged with trying to attract the film business to Michigan and dole out those tax credits to qualifying productions joins us now in the studio. It's a pleasure to welcome the director of the Michigan Film Office, Margaret O'Reilly. Good to have you with us here.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Well, we heard Randy Richardville saying that he fears cutting the film credit cap to $25 million could essentially kill off the film and TV and digital media business in our state. He thinks it should be at least $50 million, although he'd like to see it at $100 million. What do you think if that cut is enacted?
Well, from my perspective, the governor's $25 million approach is not surprising to our office. He has a long history of introducing a two-year budget, mm-hmm. and this is in line with what was introduced last year. So that part's not surprising to us, and I believe that my job is to use the resources that I have and make sure that we can leverage those funds to support the best projects for Michigan. And that, in my opinion, would mean we need a combination of different size projects, and we need to make sure that the projects we're investing in with those public dollars are ones that are going to use the most Michiganders, crew, suppliers, other services on the productions when they do come here. And I think that's what's going to really help the industry here in Michigan, is show that we have a strong base and we can provide the services that productions need.
Well, we know right now, this year, you've got about $58 million available, with $8 million of that having rolled over from 2012. So give us a sense, what kind of business is that attracting to Michigan? There were a lot of headlines earlier this year about Ryan Gosling. He's going to direct his first feature film, How to Catch a Monster, in Michigan. And how's that progressing?
Well, let me first address the question about the $58 million. Mm-hmm. That number has been reported often, and I want to just bring to your listeners' attention, 5% of our budget is legislatively mandated to be spent on post-production activities. So some of that money from post-production work rolled over from last year, and then it's another $2.5 million for the $50 million appropriated for this year. So really that $58 million figure is closer to $54 million. Mm-hmm. So that sounds like not a big difference, but I got to tell you, one of my focuses is to make sure that post-production production money gets spent, because those are typically very technical jobs. And so let's bring some of that post-production work to the state. It's already a set aside for that type of activity. And I have been sharing that message with the Hollywood producers, and they have found that very intriguing to know that that money is available and they should bring that type of work here. And we have a great base for that here as far as the technology that's needed.
And the workers
and the
to
technician
do it.
That's needed. So that, I think, is going to help build that part of the work as well. Back on the type of productions,
yes.
$50 million that we have this budget year is still a very large number. We made some program changes from a year ago. The program is now a refund program. That is money that goes out after the production is done, after we have certified the appropriate expenditures and they're allowable. So it's no money goes out the front door. Mm. But instead of being a tax credit that could go on and on mm-hmm. and on and be spread over several years, we come to the end of the production now. We certify the expenses, and then we can write that and get it off our books, and we have some more certainty. So the governor's approach to this program, which at one point was unlimited, is let's put some certainty around it. Hmm. Trying to manage a state, trying to budget for something, and when it's unlimited, we don't know what that's going to mean. By putting some certainty around it, it gives certainty for everybody. And the producers in Hollywood love it that it's a refund program and not a credit, because it's money they get immediately and it's done. That is one big thing. As far as the types of productions we are attracting, I'm very happy with our mix of projects. We have a lot of interest from some very large projects, some that aren't quite announced. We have some, but we just announced one about Need for Speed. I think I mm-hmm. mentioned that, and that's a fairly decent-sized project.
Now, what is Need for Speed?
It's a movie about that's a takeoff on the game Need for Speed, mm-hmm. the video game. And it's about a car race that goes across the country from New York to California. And so they'll be shooting for a week in Detroit. And so we're excited about that because the cars that they're using for the movie shoot were made in Michigan. They're all these kit cars made from a company here in Michigan. So that was some jobs that really help support the industry, and we're very much based here on our knowledge and our expertise here in the state, the auto industry.
Well, what kind of money could something like that, a big production like that, bring in? A Need for Speed or a How to Catch a Monster? What could Michigan's economy see from that?
Some of the Michigan spends on some of these larger projects, mm-hmm. there's one in particular that we are going through the process with right now. Their applications on this one particular one I'm thinking about is a Michigan spend of close to $80 million. So it can be a lot of money that they bring into this state and they spend. Now, the projects you're talking about and some mm-hmm. of these others that are more of a middle budget range, they tend to use almost exclusively Michigan people, Michigan services, and TV series is another area that we're really trying to focus on, because those are jobs that are a little longer term and, again, use Michigan people, Michigan services, Michigan vendors,
etc. We saw that with Detroit 187.
Right, and Low Winter Sun was announced last mm-hmm. week, and that's another series about a Detroit investigator in Detroit, based in Detroit, I should say, and we're very excited that they decided to come here and have made the decision to come here.
What's the climate like for the small, independent, individual Michigan-based filmmaker, the producer, the director? Is it a welcoming climate, and are they able to apply and get some help from the state in their productions?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And in fact, like I believe I mentioned earlier, my goal is to have a mix of projects, because really the way to build this industry, just like any business, is to not put all your eggs in one basket. So we don't want to just go after one kind of project and nothing else. We don't want to spend all our money just on really big projects. We want
to have Real Steels or the Gran Torinos.
Right. We want to have a lot of the smaller projects, because, again, they're the ones that really do use the Michigan talent and the Michigan resources in this industry. And that's really a way to help establish this industry long term in the state.
Does it make your job tougher with kind of the up and down, kind of on, kind of off sense of where these credits are going and what's available? Does it make your job harder to sell Michigan to studios?
Well, I can tell you this. My background is in economic development. I've been in economic development for close to 20 years now. Incentives in general for any kind of industry have always been very controversial,
mm-hmm.
and they've always been subject to debate. That's always been high-profile debates. Do you pick winners or losers, or don't you? How do you help support your businesses in a state? And it doesn't matter if you're in Michigan or if you're in any other state. This is just a broad public policy debate about incentives. So from my perspective, coming into this job, and my background in working with incentive programs here in Michigan and in other states for 20-plus years, it was pretty natural to me, and it wasn't – I wasn't unfamiliar or uncomfortable with the idea that, wow, is this unusual and, mm-hmm. and what's really going to happen? Incentives have been debated in this state for 20 years. This is just maybe a new industry angle on it,
mm-hmm.
but the incentive idea itself has always been highly debated. And my job as the manager of this program, as I said earlier, is really to take what resources I do have that have been made available and spread them about as much as I can to help support the most Michiganders that we can.
We've been speaking with the Michigan Film Commissioner. She is the head of the Michigan Film Office, the Pure Michigan Film Office. Margaret O'Reilly joining us today on Stateside. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Still to come, we'll have a conversation about the future of online education. And then we take a look at how universities and colleges across the country might be contributing to the economic crunch they find themselves in. That story comes up in 15 minutes on Stateside, right here on Michigan Radio. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There was once a time in our state, and really our country, when going to school could have meant a one-room schoolhouse and a dusty blackboard front and center. That's how my mother went to school for her first 8 grades, and that was only 90 or so years ago. So things have certainly changed in just a few short decades. These days, Michigan is leading the way in online education. Governor Snyder's behind it, and K-12 schools as well as colleges and universities are realizing the potential in online learning. But the recent education study conducted by the Center for Michigan found that residents are less enthusiastic about online learning. So let's take a closer look. How do kids learn through online courses? What are the pitfalls and what are the advantages? Jamie Fitzpatrick is the president and CEO of Michigan Virtual University, founded in the late 1990s by the state of Michigan. It's now one of the largest virtual schools in the country. Welcome, Jamie.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, as I thought about online education, Jamie, it struck me that some parents in the early 20th century might have been just as mystified at the prospect of large classrooms as some of us today might be wary at the prospects of our kids taking some or most all of their courses online. Does that seem like a fair observation?
Yeah, I think for many of us that went through a traditional school system, the thought of taking a class online is rather novel or unique or innovative. And for most people, they conjure up an image of turning on their computer and literally watching an instructor, kind of like the way maybe public television 30 mm-hmm. or 40 years ago,
yep.
televised lectures.
Sure.
And we will make use, as most online providers, we'll make use of video clips and audio files and simulations and whatnot. But much of our online courses are not happening in a real time. So if you and I were both taking AP Physics and mm-hmm. you attended a high school in the Upper Peninsula and I was here in southeastern Michigan, We might log on completely different times of the day. So sometimes it's just conjuring up what that online course really looks like.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that leads me to wonder, because I'm sure in the more than a decade that the Michigan Virtual University has been around, classes and offerings and techniques have really evolved. So looking at what you have today, give us an idea, first of all, the kinds of courses that you offer and how they fit into a student's schedule. So if you got a kid up in the UP, it works. And if you're down here in Southeast Michigan, it works.
Sure. Well, we have well over 150 online courses. We tend to serve two kinds of students that attend schools here in Michigan. One, that student that maybe struggled, is a second semester junior, flunked a course when they were a freshman or sophomore. They know they need that as a required course before they're going to get to graduate. Mm-hmm. And we call those credit recovery courses. And those sometimes are math courses or a health course. And that really is giving young people a second chance to learn in a different venue. And then the other are courses that the student might not find available at their local high school. Last year, we served over 500 schools statewide, and many of those schools don't offer a very wide breadth of world language courses. Mm-hmm. Today, we offer Spanish, German, French, Latin, American Sign Language, Japanese, Chinese, and we're trying to develop an Arabic course. We have 18 AP advanced placement courses. When we started the virtual school back in 2000, the survey data that we had seen is about 45% of our high schools didn't offer a single AP course. So there's a huge equity element here to providing online courses because it's completely independent of a zip code.
The zip code, so the kids could be from anywhere and they're all practicing away.
Really, yeah. Take away that traditional dependency that we've had on time and place. When people think about school, they mm-hmm. think about a building. And when we think about school, we think about learning.
Good point. Good point. Now, what do you say to critics of online classes who say, kids are missing out on the classroom experience and the socializing of the classroom experience, that we could have a kid conceivably burrowed in his bedroom and never coming out because he's on his laptop all the time?
Yeah. The first thing that I would say is that well over 95% of the students that we serve are enrolled in a public school. And they're taking a single course from us. So we really play the role of supplementing a student's learning experience, whether it be that credit recovery experience or taking a course that they just simply don't have access to locally. I think some of the concerns that parents and the general public have regarding online learning, many of them are valid. We are starting to see more and more students take all of their education experience online, and those are called cyber schools. We don't operate a cyber school here in Michigan, but Michigan is probably one of 35 states that does permit that to happen. And I think it takes a special student. I have 5 children. I don't know if any of them would be a candidate for a full-time online student, but I don't have an Olympic athlete at home, which mm-hmm. are the kinds of kids that would pursue that kind of. I don't have a person with at home with a learning disability. I don't have a student at home who has a health issue who maybe physically can't get to school. So I think you have to put those concerns in context.
Good point. Are you serving homeschooled youngsters a lot?
We do. It's a relatively small percentage, but we have provided homeschool support since the inception of the virtual school back in 2000.
Now, you were mentioning to me that you were very heartened with Governor Snyder's budget unveiling. What was said that spoke to you?
Well, in 2011, the governor unveiled his special message on education, and in that message, he suggested that students be given an opportunity to take online courses. And in his budget recommendations that he released to the legislature last Thursday, he called for a proposal that would allow every student in grades 5 through 12, with the consent of their parent, to request enrollment in up to 2 online courses during any academic term or semester. And then if a student is able to demonstrate success in online learning and they have the consent of their parent and the district officials believe it's in the best interest of the student, they could take more than 2 online courses in any given term. So this is really exciting. We've seen a couple of other states that have implemented similar legislation. And what we have found is that the parent and the student demand for looking at alternative ways of learning is really growing at a very substantial rate.
Now, you do say, Jamie, as we're talking to Jamie Fitzpatrick, who's president and CEO of Michigan Virtual University, you're saying not all online courses are the same. So how do parents know whether their child is getting a good online class?
Yeah. One of the things that the governor and the legislature have asked us to do is create a Center for Online Learning Research and Innovation, and we're just staffing that and got it up and running this past October. But one of the things that we're going to be looking at is we've already published some best practices, but we're going to continue to look at those best practices and try to help create a consumer awareness piece Is the provider who is making the course available include an online teacher? There are online courses out there that don't include an educator. They're considered self-paced. And for certain things, it may not be an issue. If you wanted to say you had an interest in learning about photography, you could probably go out and learn that because that's something that you have an interest in. If it's an online course that you want to take for credit as part of your graduation expectations, you likely are going to need a teacher. Is the content aligned to the state or national curriculum standards? So there are some basic kind of fundamental things. Is the provider accredited through a national or international accrediting body that we think are important, and that quality piece really is significant?
Now, I'd like you to address the skeptics, if you will, because we've spent a lot of time on Stateside talking about that major education report from the Center for Michigan. You know, what does the public want in public education? And they found even though 44% of the people taking part in their statewide discussion said that online learning expansion is crucial or important, 29% deemed it irrelevant and not very important. So talk to those people. Why do you believe it's important and relevant?
Yeah. First of all, I am stunned. The great report that the center put out. I'm stunned that the number is 44%, that it was that high. Because I know that 10, 12, 13 years ago when we started the virtual school, I had principals and superintendents and curriculum directors looking at me like I was from another planet when we suggested students could learn online. So the fact that it's 44% in a relatively short period of time tells me that there really is a large number of Michigan residents who believe that this is part of Michigan's education future. Last year in the United States, 1 out of 5 college students took an online course, and that number continues to grow. If you look at how employees are trained in the world of work, it increasingly is dependent on the delivery of information and training and education in an online environment. So I often have people tell me that it's great that we give that student in rural Michigan a chance to take AP Physics or Mandarin Chinese. But really what you're doing at the end of the day is you're giving them an opportunity to learn how they're going to have to learn the rest of their life. And so that's what I would tell people that have concerns. Those are valid concerns, but the world has changed dramatically, and it's going to continue to change at a pretty rapid pace.
So where do you envision, Jamie, the future of education and online learning in Michigan? Let's take it out about 10 years. Where do you see it?
It's exciting because I think what we're really talking about is being able to personalize learning opportunities for every student. So just the growth of online learning for the sake of growing online, it doesn't excite me. I think what we're talking about is how do we best address the learning needs of individual students? Not all 8th graders or all 9th graders, but how do we provide a learning opportunity that is really tailored to meet the individual student's needs, that individual person? And for some kids, for many kids, online learning is going to be a key that will take them and open up a new future. To say that online learning is going to be equally beneficial for all students is analogous to saying that the face-to-face classroom is good for every student learner that we have in the state. And we know that as a system, we're graduating about 70% of our students. So the current system doesn't work for everyone. Online learning is not going to be the panacea for all learners, but for many, many kids, it's going to be a new path that's going to allow them to be successful.
Do you envision a day when that face-to-face classroom is as quaint as the one-room schoolroom that my mother went to is?
No, but what I do think is that the days of a student sitting in a classroom with 28 students and that classroom meets 1 hour a day for 5 days a week and the primary mode of instruction is a teacher standing in front of the classroom and lecturing, I think those days are numbered. I think we talk about blended learning, which is the class isn't completely online and it doesn't meet every day at the same time for the same period. It really is allowing students to meet in a group or with their instructor when they need support and when they can do things on their own and develop that independent learning skill, that they're doing that through the technologies that we have at our disposal. So it's going to look different. We'll still have schools that building those communication skills is still critical. When we ask our online teachers why they like teaching online, and these are all highly qualified Michigan educators that are scattered all over the state, probably the number one answer that we get, and I know this is completely anecdotal, is I like teaching online because I get to know my virtual students often better than the students who are in my physical classroom. So there's something about this online environment that allows for some sharing to take place that can happen in a traditional brick-and-mortar classroom, but we find that especially for some of those introverted students who maybe need a few more minutes when the teacher says, who has an idea about X, that when that student comes up with that thought, the conversation has passed them by.
Yeah.
And in a virtual classroom, time becomes just a not as critical of an element in the learning process.
We've been talking with Jamie Fitzpatrick, President, CEO of Michigan Virtual University. Thanks for sharing with us today on Stateside.
You're welcome.
From online learning, we turn now to higher education. It's certainly no secret these are especially challenging times for institutions of higher ed here in Michigan and nationally. Higher education funding has been drastically cut, tuition drastically higher. So where does this all end? And how have the universities and colleges contributed to that economic crunch they found themselves in? In the state and the national dialogue over the future of higher education, one of the important voices to be heard is that of my next guest. James Duderstadt is the former president of the University of Michigan. These days, he is serving on the recently announced National Academies Commission on the Future of the American Research University. James Duderstadt joins us now. Welcome to Stateside.
Well, thank you very much, Cindy.
Well, sir, why do you think it is that higher education has been such an easy target, if you will, for the budget cutters in Lansing and really in other states as well, as this is a national issue?
Well, it is indeed a national issue. And in fact, to take your initial statistics a little bit farther, over the entire country, we've seen the support of public higher education over the last decade cut by about 30%. Michigan, unfortunately, almost leads the pack because they've actually cut it over the last decade by 50%. In fact, we ranked 47th in the nation in the change of our support of higher education over the last decade. To some degree, it's a consequence of a weak economy, but it's also a fact, it's also because of shifting public priorities. With aging populations, people are more concerned with supportive health care. They're concerned about crime, so prisons in most states, and particularly in Michigan, are much more generously supported right now than higher education is. There are a series of other factors that have pushed higher education to the bottom of the list of priorities for public funding, and that's of great concern to states like Michigan. But I can also assure you from this National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine study that's been requested by Congress,
mm-hmm.
it's of immense concern to the United States itself. These institutions do 60% of the research, basic research for the country. They produce 70% of the scientists, the engineers, the doctors, and other knowledge professionals. And the states have pushed them to the brink. They're at great risk right now. And the danger of that is it not only is crippling the capacity of many of these states to get prepared for the global knowledge-driven economy, but it's put the nation itself at great risk. It's affecting national prosperity. It's affecting issues of public health. And most significantly, it's beginning to affect national security.
Why have we come to place less value on higher education?
Well, I think there's a bit of misunderstanding. In reality, people are very concerned, obviously, about increasing costs of tuition. There is a certain belief that maybe universities are not efficient enough, they're not productive enough. Within the university, we see this very determined effort, and it's across all of Michigan's universities. There's still some things that tend to capture public attention. I think of the University of Michigan, for example, which has a very highly visible athletic program, and
mm-hmm.
people see things like college coaches making, you know, several million dollars a year, or ticket prices, you know, with seat taxes and so forth, skyboxes going
sure.
through the ceiling. These are big institutions, and you can point to things on the campuses, buildings which look perhaps a bit too exotic because a wealthy donor has demanded that in return for his commitment. But those really are very superficial to the functioning of these institutions. And so the problem is that this distortion of the reality doesn't make the case strongly enough that these institutions are under enormous pressure because of budget cuts. They're doing their very best to adapt to that. But sooner or later, those budget cuts, if not addressed, are going to cause long-term damage.
Does building that shiny rec center or letting our kids have sushi for dinner, does that say the right thing to not just to policymakers but also to taxpayers?
That's part of the problem. I mean, it's in the same way that you see a coach that makes $3 million a year and you ask, does that make sense? Much of that is because these institutions are trying to attract outstanding students, and they think that the marketplace requires that. I'm not convinced that it does, and the big concern of our National Academy panel is that those relatively small and tangential activities of the university have enormous impact on distorting public perception. And that's why we've challenged the institutions to pay attention to that, to pay attention to accurately portraying what's going on, what they're doing. Those things that are pushing public perception in the wrong direction, they really have to come to grips with it and say, well, maybe we shouldn't be doing that, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's part of the issue here. The other part of it, though, is that I don't think we've articulated well enough just how critical these institutions are, both to their states and to the nation. I mean, we live in a society right now in which human talent is the name of the game. The future of Michigan is going to depend more than anything else on the degree to which we invest in our people. It's people with talent, with drive, with skill, with entrepreneurship that are going to determine the future of this state. Okay, and while our roads may be falling away and we may have visions of a great Hollywood movie industry starting in Michigan, the reality is that we're underinvesting very seriously in our future right now, which is our people, not these other things.
James Duderstadt, it's a pleasure talking with you today on Stateside, and I hope we get to do it again.
Thank you very much, Cindy.
James Duderstadt is the former president of the University of Michigan. Still to come, Michigan residents have spoken. We'll find out how you think the state should jumpstart its economy. That's coming up next on Stateside here on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, there's certainly no shortage of reporting and discussion and conversation about what should happen to breathe new life into Michigan's economy. But most of that discussion tends to revolve around the thoughts of legislators, policymakers, Governor Snyder. But what do you think should happen to help restore Michigan's economy? What do you want to see, Michigan citizen? The Michigan Economic Center at the Prima Civitas Foundation wanted to know the answer. The Policy and Action Focus Group launched its Michigan Dream Restored project last fall. And today, they're unveiling the results of a series of focus groups and a big statewide survey of Michigan residents. Joining me now is the director of the Michigan Economic Center. He's also the president of the Michigan State Board of Education, John Austin, joining us on Stateside. Hi, John.
Hi.
John, it seems that Michigan residents spoke with a very, very clear voice about what they feel Lansing should be doing to create jobs and revive Michigan's economy, didn't they?
Yeah, they did, and it was informed by these very interesting focus groups and then a survey that was broader, 1,000 people in Michigan, to see if what folks shared in the focus groups was accurate. We asked them questions like, you know, what does Michigan mean to you? What values do you think Michiganders hold in common? Even asked them to choose images that represent sort of the ideal version of the state and what it means to you. And those were very consistent. They're so proud of the state, its great beauty, our outdoors, our great lakes, place to enjoy that with family. It's a real family state. Folks really want to have communities that are great places to raise a family and keep your family close and not have your kids leave for greener pastures. You know, I heard your discussion about folks going to Chicago with Kurt Metzger.
Yes.
So they want to keep family close, and they really value hard work, you know, the hard work that built the auto industry and the other great industries, and they want hard work to be rewarded by a path to opportunity and education, and our universities and our great learning institutions are such a source of pride. So those core values, a great place to raise a family, hard work being a ticket to opportunity, a great place to escape and enjoy what's special about Michigan with your family, those then really inform what do we need to do to make those values real, make that
yes.
Michigan real. And people want to do better by education. They're worried about it being unaffordable and not as good as it needs to be. They want to do better to protect what's special about this beautiful state, clean water, you know, great park system we've been so proud of. Mm-hmm. They want communities that are attractive places to live and work with good roads. You know, great road system used to be one of our special points of pride. So they're willing to invest and better support cities, our beautiful outdoors in pure Michigan, and our great learning and education institutions, and make those the priorities for what's important to create conditions that grow jobs and make this an attractive place to live, work, and have a business.
In fact, that was 64% overall favored this public investment into, as you say, these public goods, all of the things you were just spelling out.
Right. We asked this very straightforward question. What is most important for government to do to realize this ideal of Michigan that you want to see made real again? And 64% said the most important thing government, state government can do for job creation is to provide quality education, good roads and transportation, good public services like safety, water, fire, parks, libraries that create an environment in which people want to live, work, and have a business. Only 29% said, you know, cutting taxes for individuals and business, that's what really creates jobs. So I think the public really understands that what's special about Michigan, what gives us great strength economically, historically, great roads, great universities, great outdoors and attractive state are the most important things to power our economy into the future.
With that said, John Austin, in this big survey and in the Michigan Dream Restored Project, as you talk to Michigan citizens, what about the question, where would the money come from for the public investment? Does Lansing boost taxes to put more money in its pocket for these public goods?
We tested after asking folks what are important priorities they want to do better by, whether it's community services or education, higher education. Okay, what are some ways we might organize funding streams, revenue streams that could be broadly supported across demographics and politics? In these focus groups and in the survey, you had a broad representation of Democrats, Republicans, Independents, Black, white, brown geography of Michigan.
So a really good mix.
A really good mix. And people are willing to invest more. They are willing to raise some revenue with certain preferences of who might be taxed and how we might raise taxes more broadly shared in terms of support than others. I think that it was interesting. If you package investments in ways that really speak to values that are the starting point for what Michigan citizens care about, you have a better opportunity to put together a program or a policy idea that really resonates that people want to pay for. So, for example, we tested all the different ideas of how we do better for higher education funding, you know, help more people afford college, the Business Leaders for Michigan proposal, various proposals for paying for 2 or 4 years for college, a whole different sets of ideas. Folks will really responded best to ideas for paying for college if they get something back. So, for example, a stay in Michigan college fund that forgives student loans if you stay and go to work in Michigan, or an effort to put folks to work in community service as they pay off and pay for their college experience, or even a STEM, science, technology, math scholarship program, because we need those folks if they're going to work in Michigan. But we also tested, so people want to have impact, they want to get something in return, but they also want to reward hard work, one of our core values. So when we said a Michigan Promise program that pays for higher education for all young people emerging from high school, folks didn't like that as much as when we said for those who are willing to work hard, get good grades, stay in school, and earn it.
There's some Midwestern ethics there, isn't there?
Right. So you know, part of this was how do we, with this generalized interest in doing better by these important public good investments that people know matter, like education or roads and infrastructure, how would you package an idea so that folks feel like they're getting the results they want is consonant with the values that they want? Now, and there are a variety of ways we began to test for what are broadly saleable ways that people are willing to invest more in important public goods. In terms of who pays, you see a beginning of some sense of direction. Folks are obviously always happy to tax sinners, those who smoke, gamble. Mm-hmm. They are very interested in taxing those who perhaps do damage to our beautiful state. Polluters, folks who are either coal-burning power plants, high-polluting vehicles, much more interested in taxing those folks at a higher rate so that that resource is put back into things that they care about, like Pure Michigan and clean water and parks and arts. Strong support, 63% favor a graduated income tax. You know, we've had a flat income tax. which has been dropping, too, for 12 years until recently. You know, we've been – one of the reasons we aren't able to afford good roads and higher education and education generally is we've had an economic downturn, but we've also simultaneously been cutting taxes, reducing our flat income tax rate from 7.3% under John Engler down to, I believe, 4.1% now. So folks would favor having a more progressive income tax where those who are better off and can afford it may be asked to pay more in order to subsidize education, for example, and higher education access for those who are willing to work hard and build their own opportunity in life in Michigan.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and we're speaking with John Austin, who's the director of the Michigan Economic Center at the Prima Civitas Foundation, just unveiling the results of their Michigan Dream Restored project, talking to focus groups all over Michigan, and then holding a statewide survey, basically asking Michiganders, what do you think needs to happen to make this a better state? Let's talk about the roads for a little bit here, because we certainly know it's an important issue with Governor Snyder. He talked about it in his State of the State address, wants to spend money on it. Clearly important to the people you talk to who want to see good roads and revenue raised. So where do the two agree and disagree?
Well, this is a big part of the hopes and rationale for doing this work was on something like road funding. There's this broad consensus. You know, the State Chamber of Commerce, a relatively conservative business group, all the way to the environmental community and agree we need to spend more money on roads. And it's just we haven't mustered the way to do that that we're willing to vote for and our political leaders are willing to support. So part of what we're looking for and trying to help provide some guidance on how do Michigan citizens understand and the importance of roads and infrastructure, is it a priority? And then how would they be willing to pay for it? So on that, and that's part of why we wanted to share this information, is we have these debates right now. It's terrific. The governor says it's a priority. We need to fund it. How do we do so? So I think what we're hearing from citizens are they understand. Part of it is what is the message that why would they care about roads? They seem to be saying these roads and infrastructure are important as they connect to what we value most, which includes having a great community that we're proud of, a great place to raise a family. So part of it is why are we wanting to invest more in roads? And I think perhaps it may be a more compelling argument to Michigan citizens based on what we're hearing, not to say we need to do this now because we'll have to pay for it later, which is part of what the governor was, you know, rightfully suggesting. But you know, we want communities we can be proud to live in that are attractive places to live and work.
Yes.
And they're saying it's embarrassing that the roads are crumbling. Why would anyone want to have a business here? So if you both articulate, here's why we need to do it, and then say, here's how we might pay for it, it's early and we need to do more research to fine-tune what is the exact way people prefer to pay for roads. We did test the enhanced registration fee and the a higher sales tax. On both of those, in the focus groups and the survey, folks basically thought those are too high already. They were looking for other ways, because it is a priority for them, to fund roads. So again, can we tax more fully those who pollute most, high gas guzzling cars or vehicles, you know, perhaps heavy trucks that do the most damage? Is there a way to link it to those who are most to responsible and to limit some of the damage that they do to this beautiful state? Is there seemed to be a way if we lowered the sales tax or lowered a tax, but replaced it, because people are so tired of these high gas and sales taxes,
sure,
but raise more revenue through either extension of the sales tax to services or earmarked revenues, for example, a fund that we would raise money, including either at the state or local level, new taxes that was dedicated specifically to vital services, roads, safety, fire, that kind of idea, because people really see those services as being diminished and our communities kind of struggling with inability to deliver core services, including roads. If you packaged a vital services fund, it scores off the charts. You know, people want to support that, and they're even willing, I believe, to raise some money locally at the state towards that kind of investment because they know what it's going for.
Mm-hmm. It matters right at home. It matters right to their families,
right,
and in their lives.
John, and I know some communities in Michigan, as an aside, are trying to fashion these types of approaches, whether it's, I think it's very encouraging. And I guess I want to provide what the citizens are telling us should be encouraging to our political decision makers, that they want to do better by these important foundations of our economy, including our roads, and they're willing to support revenue increases. But we have to both find the way that they understand and are willing to vote for it, both in terms of the nature of the revenue and why it's important to them.
John Austin, with the Michigan Dream Restored project completed now, what do you intend to do with the findings?
We're not complete yet. This is an interim report. We wanted to share the results of this first round of taking a broad look at different policy ideas and also really listening to citizens about what their priorities are and how they might be willing to do better by some of the things that they feel most important to the economy. We wanted to share those results, if particularly to be helpful, as we're talking about, can we do better by higher education? Can we do better by roads and infrastructure? Provide some encouragement, but also provide some directionals on how we might communicate and how we might package those investments. We do need to take some additional steps to really tune up some of these proposals to be exactly consonant with what Michigan citizens want to see happen or willing to support. So we didn't draw a tight link between how would we pay for road funding in particular that's most compelling and supportable, and what are the exact revenues to do. And we want to do some more research to helpfully tune those up. So there are some next steps, but these decisions are in the air now, and they're going to continue to be with us in the years ahead. So we wanted to share some insight from what people believe is most important in Michigan, most important to the economy, how they might be willing to support it better, and continue that process so we can build broad support or encourage action on some of these important priorities.
John, this project is called Michigan Dream Restored. What do those three words mean to you as a resident of Michigan, as someone who cares about Michigan?
I married into Michigan 25 years ago and have been happily making this my home with my family, and I think we all have kind of an intuitive sense of some of the unique assets and points of pride in the state that also matter to the economy. A beautiful state with great outdoors that is part of our unique asset. A wonderful state where a pathway to opportunity through great education and great universities was available to every man, the working man and woman. And a state with a real family tradition where in your communities you could raise your family, have your family close. That's why I'm here. And so that kind of Michigan dream of getting a better life, working hard, having the opportunity to escape up north, having the opportunity to have your kids go to a great school is a better life. That's what has been so powerful about the state story. And I think we're looking at how do we build on that reality to make this dream renewed, because people are anxious, the economy's been hurt. What do we do that refreshes that pathway to opportunity and that dream, which is our unique version of the American dream, for another generation?
John Austin is the president of the Michigan State Board of Education and speaking to us today as the director of the Michigan Economic Center at the Prima Civitas Foundation. John, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Here at Stateside, we want to hear from you. How do you think we should boost Michigan's economy? Find us at michiganradio.org. Just click on the Stateside link, and we're on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And, of course, you can tweet us at Stateside Radio. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Maya Friedman, Emily Fox, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow afternoon at 3:00.